Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a policy conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Policy, as in the set of rules established for specific situations. And since this is the High Truths on Drugs and Addiction podcast, we will talk about drug and alcohol policy. Drug and alcohol policy dates to Talmudic times. Ancient rabbis established rules or policy for their village. They told their people to avoid crossing to the neighborhood village on the Sabbath because the people there were known to drink too much. They wanted their citizens to avoid that drunken culture. The rabbis established drug policy. Drug policy can be extremely liberal, such as legalizing all drugs, allowing all medication, herbals, and snake oil with no government oversight. It can also be extremely conservative, such as the death penalty for drug possession or no medication allowed unless approved by the strict government list. As in life, the best policies are not black and white, but gray. There's often a balance of protecting public health and allowing individual freedoms. Whatever you think of the FDA, they remain the world gold standard for medication safety. Whatever you think of the Alcohol and Tobacco Bureau, without alcohol regulation, we may still be at risk of methanol poisoning and blindness. The acceptance of public health and drug policies changes over time in both the liberal and conservative directions. It took a while to establish strict tobacco policies such as smoke-free zones and now more liberal marijuana policies such as avoiding criminalizing marijuana possession. To learn more about drug policy, I reached out to a policy expert, Paul Larkin. Paul Larkin works on criminal justice, drug, and regulatory policy. Before joining the Heritage Foundation, Larkin's held various positions within the federal government in Washington, D.C., as well as private practice. He worked with the U.S. Department of Justice and argued 27 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. To learn more about Paul Larkin, check out the High Truth show notes. Paul Larkin, welcome to High Truths.
It's my pleasure. I'm honored to have been invited.
I'm honored that you agreed. I love talking about health and drug policy, and thought this is going to be a fun conversation. We also have some friends in common, Dr. Bertha Madras and Dr. Bob DuPont. So shout out to them.
Yes, they're giants in the field.
Yes, they are. And so we follow the giants, not that.
Yes. Well, actually, I grew up rooting for the New York Giants, so it kind of is a natural segue.
There you go. So now I know you're a comedian and a policy expert.
That's kind of you to say. Thank you.
But let's get to know you a little bit. And you majored in philosophy in college, and somehow that got you to working on drug policy and arguing in front of the Supreme Court. How did that happen?
I was born and raised in New York City, and I had a goodly number of family members that were in law enforcement. I had two uncles on the NYPD, a cousin who was a Treasury agent. My father was an investigator for the state. Plus, I grew up in New York City in the 50s and 60s. And back then, the French Connection wasn't a movie. It was a reality. I used to see junkies on the subway all the time. And they had such a horrible, miserable existence. I wished I could do something about it.
And in those days, we called them junkies, but now we call them people with a substance use disorder.
I know. I'm just trying to go back to what, you know, it was in the 50s and 60s. I understand completely. And I also saw far too much crime. And so I always wanted to get into law enforcement. In fact, that's why I went to Stanford Law School. There was a particular professor there by the name of Anthony Amsterdam, who I had found was the best in the criminal justice field amongst any of the law school professors. So that's why I went to Stanford. And I've been involved in the criminal justice field in one form, one fashion or another for most of my life.
So wait, finish law school and then, you know, you want to work as a police officer. You didn't become a police officer, but you wanted to, you know, protect the laws, I imagine, as a lawyer. And the drug policy specifically and health policy, how did that come about? Is that something that you knew you wanted to do?
Well, I didn't immediately go into being a law enforcement officer, although I did much later. I later didn't want to play the woulda, coulda, shoulda game. And so I became a federal agent. I went to the EPA rather than the FBI because the EPA offered me more money. Very simple. I was married with three children and I couldn't leave the money on the table. So I wound up going there and did white collar crime. But I always had an interest in drug policy and wound up doing it now at the Heritage Foundation, where I work. I'm a fellow there. In fact, I'm the Rumpel Senior Legal Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and I've spent most of the last 3 years focusing on drug policy.
Great. So tell us, what is the Heritage Foundation?
The Heritage Foundation is a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C., founded 50 plus years ago by some people who had been staffers up on Capitol Hill. It was originally designed to be principally focused on the legislative branch, and in particular, Congress. It has, however, branched out into various other areas. There are, after all, other parts of the government, including the courts. Ed Meese, who was the Attorney General under Ronald Reagan and a White House aide to Reagan, was a fellow at the Heritage Foundation later on. He was there when I got there about 12, 13 years ago, and he focused on the courts. And that's because that's what most lawyers wind up spending most of their time dealing with, either arguing in front of the courts or dealing with what the courts have done. And so Heritage is now focused not just on the federal, but also on the state governments, and not just on the legislative branch, but on the executive and judicial branches as well.
Very interesting. So it's conservative. And as we're talking about drug policy, is drug policy political?
It is, but the nature of the politics has changed over the course of the last 40 plus years. Prior to the 1990s, you had liberals and Democrats in each of the two parties. One result of that was it was much easier to reach consensus because you could always wind up cobbling together enough of a coalition to get legislation passed. But beginning in the 90s, we saw a phenomenon occur that political scientists had been urging since the 60s. And that is the development of a two-party system like they have in Great Britain. One party is liberal and one party is conservative. They have Labour and they have Tories. Well, that same shift happened in the United States. The liberals all went over from the Republican to the Democratic Party, and the conservatives switched from being Democrat to Republicans. So what used to be a political breakdown along liberal and conservative lines is now a breakdown along Democratic and Republican lines. So it's still political, but it's political in a slightly different way that makes it more difficult in order to see consensus obtained.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, and we definitely were all living this in the coming presidential election. But I thought it was the advent of social media that drove us to the extremes, while the majority of Americans, or I'd say the world or mankind, is gray. It's not in the extremes.
Well, you're right about the effect of social media. But social media is a post-Clinton administration development by and large. I mean, after all, there really wasn't a significant internet until perhaps the latter half of the second Clinton administration. So it has accelerated a development that had already taken place. The downside is, for example, that we now have tremendous polarization that we didn't used to have. And, you know, the social media has certainly contributed to that, because each side is now playing to one camp or the other rather than the people in the middle, which, you are right, that's where most of America is.
All right. So let's take drug policy and the politics of it, and we'll get into the drug policy of it. You know, if I say people are dying of fentanyl, we need to decrease that, I think whether you're a Republican or Democrat, people would agree.
Absolutely. And it's because we have had far, far too many fatalities as a result of either knowing or unwitting fentanyl use over the last decade.
Right. And so where's the partisanship in the drug policy?
Well, there are demand-side approaches and supply-side approaches. The demand-side approaches focus basically on trying to deal with people who have become either substance abusers or at risk of becoming them, whereas the supply-side approach is more law enforcement-oriented. And as the two parties moved further and further away from the middle, you saw more and more people want to focus on one strategy rather than the other. But there are so many people that either have lost someone due to fentanyl or know someone that has lost a family member due to fentanyl. Politicians, even if it's only for political survival purposes, are trying to come together to address different ways of dealing with this problem.
Well, you know, dealing with drug policy, it's not one or the other. You're not going to solve anything by just doing only supply or only demand. You have to have deterrence for the supply. And I think both parties care about that. And treatment for people who have a substance use disorder, I think also both parties care about that. And maybe the fine nuance of the partisanship is in the quantity of each of these buckets that are important into dealing with the drug problem.
Well, I think you're right. But unfortunately, one of the problems of social media and just life as we see it in America today is that there are so many people moving to the far left or far right that it is difficult to try to persuade them to come back to the middle. I mean, for example, take an entirely different subject. Take affirmative action or racial quotas. At one time, you could debate one side versus the other and come up with a compromise as to how many seats that should be set aside in a med school, a business school, law school, college, for people who are minorities and disadvantaged. But now you have some people say that all whites are racist, and others say it is completely immoral to have any decision based on skin color. And it's difficult to come to a compromise if you hold one view or the other, because there really isn't any compromise available. And there are more and more people, not always in politics, but people out there in the electorate that tend to hold one view or the other. And that's what makes it difficult to be a politician, to try to find that Goldilocks option that is not offensive to either side, but does try to solve a particular problem. And in drug policy, that's one area where that shows up.
So, I mean, using any example, whether it's, you know, the racial one you mentioned or abortion or really tough topics, I think that if we come to the understanding that most of us are in the middle and that we have people call it the gold star, the overall goal. I guess I'm an optimist. I think that we can get people together. And drugs is a great topic for bipartisanship, as long as the egos don't get in the way. Because you could say the Republicans only want border protection. That's their whole resolution for drugs, or you could say the progressives and Democrats only want harm reduction. But that's neither of those statements are true. I think everybody, all sides, care about treatment, and all cars care about the supply and decreasing that coming to the United States. And I think I could get most people to agree to that.
Well, it's not that I agree or disagree with it. I just tend to think that perhaps what is happening is the people at the extremes have the loudest voices.
That's true. That's absolutely true and annoying.
Yes. And the problem with that is you wind up seeing people basically, you know, singing to the choir on one side or the other. And it's difficult to get somebody to say there is a Goldilocks option that we should pursue, because you are going to then potentially irritate, if not offend, people on both sides, because no one is going to think that the middle ground position, which is a compromise, is morally acceptable. Now, when you're talking about saving lives, which is something you do on a daily basis, it may be that we have to sacrifice some of the ideological purity we might otherwise have to try to corral enough people towards middle of the road solutions that deal both with the border and with treatment, so that we can try to save the number of people that we're seeing now lost to overdoses due to fentanyl.
Yes. And the part that's missing these days, I think, is the prevention, the primary prevention aspect, which is the other, as Dr. Bertha Madras says, our three-legged stool of, you know, supply, prevention, and treatment.
Yes, I agree. Prevention is critically important.
Yeah.
I mean, what you have oftentimes is someone who would not fit the typical image of a drug abuser. It may just be a college student who needs to stay up late to study for an exam or to finish a term paper, and ask somebody if they have something that can help them stay awake. And this person got it over the internet. And it turns out that what they got over the internet is not a drug that is made by a legitimate pharmaceutical company. And as a result, it has a fatal amount of fentanyl in it. I'm sure that has happened in a non-trivial number of cases.
Yeah.
It's absolutely true. People are making a mistake and it's costing them their lives. They don't necessarily have a substance use disorder. I'm frustrated that we don't have the research to quantify that yet.
No, I am too. But I also think one of the messages, unfortunately, that isn't getting out there often enough is that fentanyl has changed the rules of the drug experimentation game. Yep. Back in the 60s and 70s and maybe even into the 80s and later, drug experimentation wouldn't cost you your life. Today it can.
Yeah.
And as the result, as I've said at different schools when I've talked to them, for all practical purposes, you have to accept the fact that the days of drug experimentation are over, because right. You don't know what it is you're getting, and you don't deserve to die because you made a mistaken choice or even a dumb choice. That's not the proper penalty for people who make mistakes or do dumb things. And yet that's what's happening.
Right.
And what kid, including myself, has never made a dumb mistake in their life?
Yeah, numbers don't go high enough to count the number of dumb mistakes I've made, I'm sure.
So drug policy, again, before we get into specifics, it's a balance. And drug policy, I always think about it in terms of a health policy, I guess, because I'm a physician, but I guess, you know, for supply, it may be different. But in either way, it's the right balance between protecting public health and individual freedom. We saw that with the pandemic, right? Keep people with masks inside versus individual freedom. And there's a balance depending on the threat. And with drug policy, I think it's the same. You can be like some countries where, you know, possession of drugs gives you the death penalty, or what we're coming to in this country, which is everything is, you know, the goal for some people, I guess the far left, would be to have it all legalized, no penalty, and, you know, the greatest individual freedom, which actually cost people's lives.
Yes, I agree. The extremes on each side are far from optimal. We need to approach this, as you mentioned, from the three-legged stool approach, and prevention and treatment are important parts of that. Sadly, one of the problems we have because of the polarized debate is you don't see people making the point that we need prevention, we need treatment, and we need enforcement. I mean, I've written about some programs, the 24/7 sobriety program and the Hawaii Opportunity Probation with the Enforcement Program, where they do actually use the criminal justice system, but they don't use it like a hammer. If you have a drug problem, you first can go through detox, and then you are regularly but randomly drug tested. And if you test hot, you go in, but not for 15 or 20 years. It may be 24 hours or 48 hours. And it's easy to keep somebody because the drug testing is done at the jail. So if you test hot, you just don't leave for the next day or two. And it increases in length if you keep testing hot. But it's designed to use some degree of compulsion to force people to address this very serious problem they have. And the 24/7 sobriety program and the HOPE programs should be more widely used. I'd like to see that happen. Because for some people, as Dr. Sally Satel said, you need some amount of coercion in order to get them into the proper treatment program, the proper frame of mind. As you mentioned, Bob DuPont, Bob is a big supporter of the same approach.
It's compassionate. And some people, you know, need that type of determinance. And you'll speak to people. I've talked to countless of people who said, going to jail saved my life.
Yeah. No, it's jail is not a fun place to be. When I was an agent, I had to go into jails and prisons to interview people. I didn't like being there, and I knew I could leave. The people who I were interviewing were inmates, and they couldn't. It's a horrible place. But unless you have the potential for coercion, there are a goodly number of people that will not be able to force themselves to give up their drug habit. And then, of course, you have other options, too. You have medication-assisted treatment. You have methadone, which I remember coming into everyone's attention back in the 60s, because New York City was one of the first places to have a methadone program. And now we have buprenorphine. So we have some treatments that are available, but sadly, we don't have them for every drug. For example, there's no treatment for methamphetamine. And methamphetamine abuse in some places is as rampant, if not more rampant, than opioid abuse.
Yeah, it's where I am in San Diego. We're ground zero for methamphetamine. We did one study where we took urines from our emergency departments that were going to go for drug testing, and 76% of them were positive for methamphetamine. So we're kind of the capital of meth. And you're right, there's no medication that treats methamphetamine use disorder, although there is treatment. It's just not a medication.
Right. Hopefully, there will be some scientific development that allows for a treatment and allows for it to be done on a long-term basis. Yeah. For example, there are some drugs that allow medicine to implant a device that then releases the drug over time so that you don't have to show up every day like you would for originally that you
had. Sustained release, it's called.
Yes. Thank you. A sustained release formulation of a drug that deals with the withdrawal symptoms of drugs like opioids and methamphetamine and others would be an enormous breakthrough. You know, the number of lives they would save would justify a Nobel Prize in medicine for whoever was able to come up with it.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about more about supply, the supply size, because I know that that's a lot of your writing goes along that. You worked in, like you said, organized crime and racketeering. What do we know we need to do about that? I think that that should be bipartisan. Like, let's get after the suppliers. And supplies matters a lot, not a little. We don't have a heroin problem because of supply. We have a fentanyl problem because of supply.
That's right. Yeah. And I don't think enough people realize that the problem with heroin is demand driven and the problem with fentanyl is supply driven.
Huge supply. Right.
When he was in office, President Trump persuaded Chinese Premier Xi not to send finished fentanyl to the United States or to try to take efforts to prevent illicit fentanyl was coming into the United States.
And he accomplished that.
Well, yes, he accomplished that. But the problem is the Chinese then just switched over to sending the precursor chemicals.
Right.
And the Chinese pharmaceutical and chemical industries are huge. They account somewhere between 15 and 20% of the gross domestic product that China has each year. And there are very few, relatively speaking, inspectors and the like. And somebody that powerful carries a lot of weight in politics. So they're still sending over to Mexico all the precursors. And it is not difficult to make. There was an article a day or two ago in Reuters in which they had done an investigation. And they said they are able to manufacture or have the ability to manufacture $3 million worth of fentanyl. And all it took was $3,600 and a web browser. So you think about that. We have to try to stop fentanyl from coming across the border. The administration has said they're doing a good job, they say, trying to stop people at ports of entry. Well, there's a lot of space in between the ports of entry, and nothing comes across the border that the cartels don't have a hand in. So there's a huge number of people coming across the border between ports of entry who are carrying even small amounts of fentanyl, because you don't need much of it to make a lot of money.
And even within ports of entry, we're only capturing at best 5-10%.
Right. And since it is so profitable, they're going to continue to send it through every means they can think of. And if they don't send it through trucks and they don't send it through people illegally entering the U.S., they'll send it through private delivery services like UPS, FedEx, or they'll send it via drones. So we have to increase our ability to stop it from coming in from Mexico. That's one of my criticisms of the Biden administration. The public feels that the federal government doesn't care because they're not stopping people from coming in. And some of them, an unknown number, have fentanyl. And that's corrosive. The government loses the confidence of the public that it is trying to deal with this problem, and then no one's going to believe what they have to say.
But what about going uphill from that? The reason that it's coming and flowing here, it's because it's very lucrative. It's about the money. How do we get and deter drug trafficking at upstream and making it costly?
Well, one thing we have to do is persuade Mexico to go back to the strategy that it used to follow before the current president, AMLO, took charge. He's about to transition to a new president. It may have even happened. I haven't kept up with that. But before he was the president, they were trying to assist the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Department of Homeland Security, to deal with this. And since then, they've just given that up. Now, my guess is he probably decided to do this as sort of a tacit offer to the cartels that he would not rigorously enforce the drug laws if they would reduce the amount of homicides in Mexico, because Mexico is suffering a horrific rate of homicides, kidnappings, disappearances, and the like. But we have to try to enlist the support of Mexico, and we have to try to enlist the support of China, which knows which of the companies are manufacturing the precursor chemicals, and India, because India also has the ability to manufacture precursors and is doing it. So that's something that falls in the bailiwick of the State Department and the intelligence community. We need to find out more about what is coming in to Mexico or into the United States in other ways.
All right, so let's talk about some policies that relate to the supply. And just the other day, Biden-Harris White House announced their counter, what did they call it? The counter the scourge of fentanyl and other synthetic drugs policy. I think I shared it with you. I kind of wanted to take your read on that. Never mind, it's happened now, you know, at the end of the administration, should have happened at the beginning. But anyway, still good things, or no?
Taking effective steps to prevent the problem from occurring is always worthwhile. But when you wait till the tail end of your administration to do that, it certainly looks like it's all politics and no substance. I mean, it starts out by saying, for example, dealing with fentanyl is a core priority of the Biden administration, and that they are now going to take various new steps to address this. If it was a core priority, they would have taken these steps earlier, because the Drug Enforcement Administration and law enforcement has recommendations that haven't been followed. I mean, one thing to do to force Mexico into this is just close the border. Just if you shut down the border entirely, nothing goes in, nothing comes out until Mexico decides to help us.
Is that a practical thing? We've done it once before, right? When Ricky Caminera was brutally murdered and border agents just shut down. That was one of theirs that was taken, and they shut down the border and they got his body back.
Yes. No, I understand. I'm not saying you can do this in perpetuity, but you have to give some indication that you're willing to be forceful. And we haven't seen that. And you have to give the people on the other side, the president of Mexico, law enforcement, military, an out so that they can then take measures that they might want to take, but can't, because the president is saying, I don't want to do this. I mean, it may well be the person, people below the level of the president in Mexico want to take these steps, but they couldn't because the president said no. So maybe something like this gives them a chance, the people at the lower level, to persuade the new president to do something.
So let me give it to you. Let's say this is all political. Like, I think, you know, both sides of the aisle do things for political reasons. Is this good policy, like what they're saying, or is it something that won't happen until after January, and it would either be inherited by whoever the next president is?
Well, I think the latter is the likely result. This is August. The Senate and the House will be on recess for most of this month. When they come back in September, the only thing they will work on, by and large, are appropriations. I worked for Senator Orrin Hatch, and he was the chair of the Judiciary Committee. I was the head of the crime unit. And September was all appropriations all the time, because the new fiscal year begins on October 1. And this year, anything that's contentious isn't really likely to make it through one house or the other, or both, because we have a presidential election coming up in November, 1 month past the beginning of the new fiscal year. I really think anything that anybody's proposing now is going to be something that the new administration is going to be responsible for addressing.
Right. So, and again, this new announcement is not an executive order. It's that we want Congress to do these things, which, again, won't be timely.
Right. And it's, you know, basically punting like that,
right,
is a way of trying just to shift blame to somebody else, so that if Congress doesn't do something, each side can blame the other for nothing being done. That, you know, that's politics, pure and simple. That's not policy, and that's not a good way to make policy.
Yeah, so this is a punt, although the ideas in it sound good to me, like pill mill registry, permanently rescheduling fentanyl as Schedule 1 for the illicit fentanyl, and getting all branches of the federal agencies to work on the supply. Who would oppose that?
Well, you're going to have to, at least to do one of those things, revise a 50-plus-year-old provision in the Controlled Substances Act. Schedule 1 is set aside just for drugs that have no legitimate medical use. Fentanyl does have a legitimate medical use.
Right. I use fentanyl.
Right. It's used.
Not on myself, on my patients.
I know what you meant. I know what you meant. It's used by anesthesiologists and it's used by oncologists, principally, I guess.
No, GI doctors work it to do your colonoscopy. It's in the ER. It's everywhere.
Yeah. No,
it's a good medication.
I understand. So you really can't put fentanyl into Schedule 1 because it has legitimate medical uses. So you have to come up with a new category for things that have legitimate medical uses, but you're going to restrict perhaps even more than you would Schedule 2 drugs. Because Schedule 2 drugs, for example, in the case of Oxy, you can't call in the prescription anymore. I believe you have to actually have the script and take it to the pharmacy. You have to do things like that, and that may require some rejiggering of the way the definitions are in the schedules.
Now I have to look this up a little more because I thought that there's a way to differentiate the illicit fentanyl from the medicinal one and all the carfentanyls and all the fentanyl analogs.
Well, the carfentanyls and all the analogs, if they also have legitimate uses, there's a potential.
Those don't.
Problem there. If you don't have a permit to manufacture it, and you're manufacturing it, and you're smuggling it, then it's quite clearly illegal because you have to have a permit to manufacture it, to transport it, you have to be a licensed physician to recommend it, all of that sort of stuff. But I'm just not confident that switching fentanyl over to Schedule 1 would not upset the ability of people to use it for its legitimate purposes. I think we have to just discuss that in a little more detail.
So I work with Families Against Fentanyl, and the focus for the organization is to declare fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction in order to get the whole of government to work on the supply end. This could be done by an executive order of the president. I don't know if either party is, thinking along those lines yet, although we're getting more traction and more acceptance into this declaration. What do you think?
Well, it's similar to the question of whether we should designate the Mexican drug trafficking organizations as foreign terrorist organizations.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we get any additional authority to do things that we otherwise can't do now by making either of those designations. I mean, there are a lot of people that thought if you designate the drug trafficking organizations in Mexico as foreign terrorist organizations, you can then use the military, and that's not the case. The question of whether you can use the military in another sovereign country is not something that was contemplated by the statute that deals with drug trafficking.
Can't you freeze their bank assets?
Well, I'm not sure that there's anything we get from making it a weapon of mass destruction or making the cartels, drug trafficking organizations, foreign terrorist organizations that we can't do right now. I mean, there are a lot of weapons we have out there. I'm not sure what it adds to what we have. And that's why I'm not sure it is necessary to do that in order to do the things that we want to do.
We're trying to get whole of government approach in, and then everybody would focus on it, kind of like, you know, the statement of what the Biden-Harris administration just meant, but, you know, right away with all eyes laser focused on this problem, as it should be. It's the number one health problem in our country right now.
I agree with that, but the phrase whole of government is just thrown around sort of profligately these days. I'm not sure what the Railroad Retirement Board can contribute to the fight against fentanyl. I'm not sure what the Department of Labor has to do, or the Occupational Safety and Health Administration has to do that can help us. It's a nice phrase. I mean, it's like saying, oh, we're going to put all, you know, 40 plus football players on the field at one time. But I'm not sure that all of these additional players have any serious contribution that they can add to what we're doing.
Yeah, maybe I am throwing that phrase around, and it should be, but more on the deterrence, more priority on the deterrence, which goes to one of the policies that you wrote: swift, certain, and fair punishment, sobriety, and hope. Is that kind of what we need in deterrence?
Well, that is particularly good to deal with the individuals who are substance abusers. It's not a particularly good program to deter people from engaging in drug trafficking. You would much rather use the Department of Treasury and the Department of State to combine their resources with their counterparts in foreign nations in order to identify where all of the money from drug trafficking is, you know, being deposited. Now, that's a difficult thing to do, because I'm sure one of the events that's happening is the cartels are loading huge containers of cash and sending it to China, and then China is effectively laundering that throughout the rest of the world. And they are not going to be very willing to assist us unless we give them something in return. And not everything that they want is something we would be willing to give up. So I don't know how much we can do to deal with that specific aspect of this problem, although I do think the State and Treasury Departments are probably trying to do what they can right now with foreign nations to deal with the money laundering problem.
So to kind of divide our topics here, as far as deterrence for the individual and deterrence for the drug cartel, in California, we have a proposition that would take back Prop 47 and reinstate drug courts, and it'll be on the ballot in November. And I think the principle is that if you're merciful to the cruel, and some people are, and I think that that's where the politics comes in, where the left side of the aisle would be more merciful to the offenders, and the right side would, you know, have sterner punishment. But the saying is, if you're merciful to the cruel, you're letting the drug dealers off, then you're actually being cruel to the merciful, and cruel to the victims, and cruel to that individual in preventing them from having the opportunity to get better. I do see that philosophical divide, and hopefully we will get to some of that merciful deterrence in California.
I think Oregon made a mistake in the way it went about decriminalizing drug use back in 2020.
I think Oregon thinks they also made a mistake.
Yes.
Yeah, and they changed it earlier this year.
I mean, one of the big problems was Oregon decided overnight to switch from a law enforcement strategy to a treatment strategy, and they didn't have the treatment facilities in place.
They didn't. If you look at the law, they didn't want to do treatment. It was screening, and that doesn't get you anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, they had this funny system where you give somebody a ticket, and then they had to pay $100, or they could call a treatment center, and that was enough.
A screening center. It wasn't actually a treatment center. It was screening you.
Oh, well, even worse. Yeah. So, I think that system didn't work. We've seen that. And one of the lessons we have to take away from it is that we might need some coercive elements to whatever strategy we're going to adopt. And that's where the sobriety, 24/7 sobriety and hope programs, I think, have an advantage over just completely decriminalizing this with a screening system like the one Oregon had. If California is going to do something to use some degree of coercion, it doesn't have to be sending somebody to prison for 5, 10, 15 years, but something to force them to stop their drug use, that short-term use of coercion may have a long-term benefit by getting somebody off drugs.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I guess I call it deterrence instead of coercion, but maybe it's the same kind of thing. But and I think it applies to a lot of life, not just with drug policy, right? As a mother, right, I have deterrence when I'm raising my children of what I want them to do, not do, because I love them, not because I'm mean. But there have to be, you know, boundaries and consequences.
No question. You give your child a timeout if he or she does something wrong. You don't sentence them to their room for the rest of their life.
Right.
And you don't ignore it. There is a middle ground there. And that does provide a deterrent effect for the future, because if the timeout is unpleasant, the child will remember that and hopefully avoid doing whatever he or she did that led to that. So I'm hoping that California goes about this in a better way than Oregon did.
Yeah. And as far as, so that's at individual level and local kind of drug dealing. But internationally, okay, you're sitting at the Heritage Center and you're going to write a policy. What is the gold opinion to deal with this?
Well, if you're talking about dealing with it at a global level.
I want not so much the globe. If we're going to be partisan, America first. I don't want fentanyl in the United States. I want to increase the supply right here. Okay. And by that, it'll happen to the rest of the world. The rest of the world will follow.
Okay. Let me make a few points.
All right.
First, it's a noble goal, but we have to be aware of its limitations. We were never able to stop all of the heroin that made its way into the U.S. We're never able to stop all of the cocaine that made its way into the U.S. And so we have to be realistic. We have to limit it to the maximum extent we can, but there is a floor probably which below we cannot go. Secondly, we have to be aware of the risk that if we stop it from coming into the U.S., since it is such a valuable product, all you might be doing is shifting the manufacture of fentanyl from Mexico to within the United States. And since it doesn't take a Caltech-educated high school chemistry teacher in order to manufacture the fentanyl, and I'm referring to, you know, Breaking Bad, you might see the growth of laboratories, particularly in the Western U.S., where there are vast areas where there is no one. And if you can make this in, you know, an 18-wheeler inside the bed of a truck, you're going to see that happen. So you have to be aware that people may just shift the manufacturing site from outside the U.S. to inside the U.S. You also need to be aware that we have to figure out more ways of increasing the likelihood of success in treatment. First-time efforts to quit smoking, like first-time efforts to quit many other addictive substances, fail far more often than they succeed. We need to do a better job of trying to figure out how we can change that. Think about it. Nobody in the House or the Senate wants to go to the well and argue in favor of spending billions of dollars for a program that will fail 80% of the time. We need to lower the failure rate, increase the success rate, but we also need to be honest with people that we're not going to succeed all the time. Because one of the problems we have with government right now is that they have promised too much and delivered too little, and people just don't trust them anymore. Look at all the stories coming out about COVID. We had the 6-foot rule, and now everybody agrees there was no science for that. There are terribly large numbers of people that just don't trust the government, even in the medical and scientific area. And we have to reverse it. We have to reverse that. That's important too.
Okay. What about, okay, so there's not, you were saying before about going diplomacy, you know, the Treasury Department, the State Department, as far as dealing with the supply. I think there's things domestically we could do too about a lot of this stuff is all drug dealing happens with the phone. And I think if we had greater deterrence and accountability for buying these kind of drugs on the internet or on Craigslist, or, you know, we have other, you know, domestic partners that could be more proactive in helping in drug supply.
Well, the DEA and the federal government.
If we had more deterrence, you know what? If you got caught with a major penalty, if you got to pay $1 million every time there was, you know, fentanyl sold in pills on Snapchat, then Snapchat would figure out a way to stop doing that. They'd have a program. They'd figure it out.
No, I understand. Keep in mind, though, to some extent, we have that right now, because if you're talking about pills, you're now dealing with the issue that's called the unit of prosecution, is a bag of fentanyl that has 50 pills, one violation or 50. And the statutes generally don't address that. So my guess is you could probably get a lot more deterrence right now if you took a very aggressive approach to how you charge and prosecute some of these offenses. I think one of the big changes we need to make in our criminal justice system is to refocus our federal law enforcement efforts on matters that occur at an international level, a transborder level, and a national level. For example, the FBI doesn't need to be solving bank robberies anymore. The local police department can handle that. The FBI needs to focus on transnational, transborder, and national level crimes, because those are the ones that the state and local law enforcement departments can't handle. Now, the problem with that is people in the House and Senate want the FBI to solve local crimes because they want to be able to call up the director and say, we got a big bank robbery problem in Boise. And you assign some people to deal with it. And since the members of the Senate and House vote on the FBI's budget, the director is inclined to be generous when people make those calls. But we need to devote more of the assets that we have in the federal government to purely transnational, transborder, and national problems, rather than trying to deal with problems that are confined within a geographic area of any one particular state.
But the social media and the selling of drugs to kids, again, happens through these applications. When Surgeon General Vivek Murphy announced that he wants to put warning labels on social media, I thought, okay, whatever. We have warning labels on movies, and he wants to do that for social media. I don't know how effective that would be. I was kind of hoping he'd say, we want deterrence on social media and people having accountability for selling drugs through these applications.
Well,
that is something that could be done. You know, I mean, these applications are the drug cartels.
Yeah. No, putting warning labels on social media is likely to be as effective as those signs in washrooms that tell employees they have to wash their hands. Yeah. After using the men's and ladies' room. I don't think we get 100% compliance with those. And I think the fact that it would be more risible than effective is only going to, you know, damage any effort in that regard. But, you know, you can either use the stick or the carrot. Every time a social media company identifies and assists law enforcement with the discovery of a fentanyl trafficking ring, give them a reward. And then you're putting it in their financial interest to try to ferret out fentanyl trafficking on social media. Don't just look at it as a way of punishing them. That's the only tool available. Make it in their financial interest. Figure out a reward system that, you know,
that works. A tax break. A tax break for every drug trafficker.
You betcha. Okay. And then you can make some will be above the line, some will be below the line. I mean, there are different ways of doing this. Then you can have different amounts. You can put caps. However, I mean, there are different rules of the road that you can develop to deal with it. Not everything has to be a punishment. Sometimes you're better off trying to encourage assistance rather than command it.
Interesting. Drugged driving. I know you've written about that. What needs to happen, drug policy, with that?
One, and most importantly, we have to recognize that it is a serious problem. Gil Kurakowski was the director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy during the Obama administration. And he said that
he's going to be on the show.
He's a great fellow. Yeah. He really is. He knows his stuff. He's very savvy. You tell him I said that. He's a great guy. He said that the problem of drug-impaired driving is as serious as alcohol-impaired driving. And yet we didn't see President Obama do anything. We didn't see President Trump do anything. And we haven't seen President Biden do anything. Although there's time left before the election, maybe he'll do something now, particularly if somebody in his administration, you know, watches your show. But we need to recognize it. Why? Because we've had a tremendous movement in this country ever since 1996 to legalize cannabis for medical and recreational use. And medical cannabis is actually an oxymoron. It's really just, you know, recreational use dressed up with a written recommendation from a physician. That's a serious problem. And we need to address it by adopting essentially the same approach we would for drunk driving. Now, the problem we have is twofold. One, we don't have a breathalyzer that we can use at roadside to see how many nanograms of THC someone has in his or her blood, and therefore in his or her brain. And secondly, we don't know what the minimum cutoff would be to render somebody intoxicated, because it varies greatly depending on whether or not you've developed a tolerance to a particular level. We have 0.08 for alcohol.
We made that up. That was not based on science. We just kind of made it up.
It's not based on, you're absolutely right. That's a political compromise. Right. There are a large number of people that are impaired at 0.05. And there are Scandinavian nations that have 0.02.
And things are additive, because you find people with alcohol and marijuana, which in your 0.08 is like down to 0.02 because you've got THC on board.
Bingo. You hit my next point, which is that the two of them have a synergistic effect. Mm-hmm. You add alcohol and THC, and even if you don't fail the BAC test, if you've smoked a doobie, you're going to be incapable of driving. So one of the things to do is require that anybody who purchases cannabis basically give up drinking and driving. If you have anything over 0.0 in terms of alcohol, and you have a medical cannabis recommendation, or you're purchasing it, then you can't be out there drinking and driving, because the odds are that you're not going to be able to tell that somebody is.
And we do that in medicine, right? You know, if you get your colonoscopy and get pain medications, you leave the ER with pain medications, you say, don't drive. We need someone else to drive you.
Right. Even if you don't get pain meds, the mere fact that you have been anesthetized.
Yeah. Do not drive.
legally incapable of driving for 24 hours in most states. That's why they always want somebody else to drive you home.
Makes sense. So, if it's medicine, if it's your medicine, then you shouldn't be driving with it if it's impairing.
Right. And there are other things to
do. We do that with other prescriptions.
Use the same license suspension programs. All the remedies that we have come to accept in the case of alcohol impaired driving should also be used in the case of drug and cannabis impaired driving, because people are going to be maimed or killed.
They already have.
And they already have. Look at the data in Colorado. There's a goodly number of people who aren't with us anymore because of that.
I've talked to some of the parents who've lost their children because of cannabis impaired driver.
And tell those parents to contact their senators, congressmen, and the president, because none of the last three have said anything about it.
So you were saying, just to recap kind of what you're saying about dealing with the impaired driver, is that if you're going to use cannabis, don't drive for so many hours?
Right. I think the last I read was it's at least 8 hours, and that would be a reasonable.
They did a simulation test with smoked products, and it was 4.5, where people don't have the perception that they're impaired, but they are when they get behind the simulator, and at least 8 or more for edibles.
Oh, yeah. Then the problem with edibles, of course, is people have an edible, and if they're used to smoking it, it doesn't hit them right away because it has to go through the GI tract. And so they keep taking more edibles, and they get really, really wasted hours down the road. And then they're, you know, if they're in a car taking a trip and all of a sudden it hits them like a hammer, they and everybody else on the road is in trouble.
So, but as far as the drug driving, you know, it's two problems. One is the public health messaging, which is, you know, don't drive while you're impaired with any drug, right? Whether it's alcohol or your prescriptions or cannabis or anything else that you're taking. Specifically for cannabis, to wait, you know, at least 4 hours and don't get behind the wheel. And don't let other people, don't let, you know, kids know if somebody else was, you don't get behind the wheel. It's just the same messaging with alcohol. But what about the enforcement piece?
Oh, there are different rules that you can adopt. You can, I mean, for example, there's a related problem. Cannabis has not been shown to be safe and effective for women who are pregnant or nursing. And there is a real risk. Make it a crime to sell cannabis to any woman who is pregnant. Because what you're doing is putting the woman's child at risk. Or if somebody has been purchasing cannabis from a particular dispensary, make the dispensary liable for any accident that occurs within 24 hours of the sale.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, what if they didn't use it till later? You know, they kept it.
Hey, I understand. But you're going to be unable to have a perfect correlation. You can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Interesting. All right. Illegal to sell. I mean, low-level food, fruit is not to sell to people, to women who are pregnant. All right. Interesting. All right. So that's drug driving. Cannabis capitalism, something else that you wrote about. Is that kind of the same kind of thing? I mean, I could think of lots of, you know, we didn't even talk about caps on potency or childproof containers, getting rid of the candies that's poisoning children.
It's the sale of edibles that resemble candies that children eat is despicable. Because it's quite clear what they're doing. And anybody who does that, who manufactures and sells those, should be prosecuted, because we should outlaw that. I think
you would think that that would be easy, right? So I proposed a law in California. First year was I wanted labels, okay, because people love weed in California. So I said, just let's do what we did for tobacco. Let's just put a label like we, same kind of laws that we did for tobacco, like we have for alcohol, like we have for flashing lights in movies. And we had just putting labels on cannabis products. Legislator, governor shot that down. The next year, I thought, okay, well, what would be not controversial that we have the data for? And I thought, okay, what about babies? You know, they don't have a substance use disorder. They're crawling around the floor, finding a gummy, putting in their mouth and ending up in the ICU or on a ventilator. So we have the data on that in California. The number one cause of pediatric poisoning in California, in the United States, is marijuana. So we have the data. So let's just have a law that get rid of these candies. Like, why do you need them? Like, adults, you could use whatever you want, but don't make it in candies. That didn't fly.
You know, I think you shouldn't give up on either of those because you have all the policy arguments on your side. And sometimes you need three streams to run together. You need the problem stream, what is something that has to be addressed, the policy stream, the answer to that problem, and then the political stream, some event that forces politicians to act. How did we wind up getting so involved in alcohol-impaired driving? Because Candace Lightner's daughter was killed by a drug driver. It's sad to think that we would have to have something similar to happen to an infant or a toddler in this area before politicians act. But it's sad, but it may be true. We need something like that. You need some big, horrible event and big media attention to it, because then the public will demand that the politicians do something about it. And perhaps not until those three streams run together, problem, policy, and politics, will you see something like that. But you have got a serious problem, and you have got two very good policy solutions. Don't give up on them. Stay with them. Sometimes it just takes a while.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul. I do tend to be ahead of my time. So it's just a matter. You're right. It's just a matter of time. Maybe a little with that. What about the rescheduling debate? That's kind of been a political issue. I don't know if it's partisan, but it's interesting because both people who are selling cannabis and the you know, prevention folks don't like the rescheduling of marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3.
You know, the truth is there isn't anything that has changed from when the Obama administration rejected a proposal to reschedule cannabis. And it didn't come up until late, I think it was, in 2022, when the president told the attorney general and secretary of health and human services to look at it. And then the attorney general decided to make a public announcement in the Federal Register of his intent to change it only a month ago. So it just screams politics as to what's going on here. Why? And because for the last 80 plus years, we have trusted the Food and Drug Administration to decide what is a drug and whether a drug is safe and effective. And we've made it a crime for any drug to be distributed in interstate commerce, any new drug that is not safe and effective. And rescheduling cannabis under the Controlled Substances Act has no effect on the fact that it is illegal to distribute cannabis in interstate commerce under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. All we've done is try to euchre the public into thinking once it's rescheduled, now they'll be able to get it anywhere, everywhere, as much as they want or whatever. It'll still be a crime under the FDCA to ship it in interstate commerce. And so the people who are arguing in favor of this rescheduling aren't addressing that aspect of the issue. And it's really, therefore, I think, just a pure political effort to appeal to the stoner vote. That's, you know, all it is.
It does amaze me that we have a whole election that was won based on follow the science. And now it's like, follow the science unless I disagree with it.
Right. You know, look, hey, Washington, D.C. essentially is a truth-free zone. Okay? It's like that old TV show years ago, The Dome. There's a dome over Washington, D.C., and it's you're not going to get truth inside it there. And that's what's happening.
Wow. All right. Well, gosh, there's so much more we could be talking about. But if you were advising the next president, regardless of who wins, on drug policy, what needs to happen in the first 100 days?
Okay. First, the president should say that what Gil Kerlikowske said when he was the drug czar back in the Obama administration is true. Drug-impaired driving is a serious national problem. It's a problem because people will buy drugs in a state like California and drive elsewhere in California. They'll buy drugs in California and drive to other states where they can't be sold, but they've been using them. It's a national problem. Nebraska doesn't have legal cannabis. Colorado does. But people from Colorado drive to Nebraska, and Nebraskans are therefore at risk of being maimed or killed if a person is one toke over the line and is behind the wheel of a car. We need to start addressing that problem. We need to have the Office of National Drug Control Policy, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, and the Department of Transportation, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, put their heads together, figure out what we know and what we don't, and then figure out what we should do immediately or over the very short haul based on what we know, and then what we should do to find answers to what we don't know. And the president needs to say that him or herself. Because until you make it an important issue at that level, there are so many other things that are just going to crowd it out. Secondly, if we're going to have this split system that we now have where cannabis is illegal under federal law, but it's legal under the states, Congress needs to get together and make a decision. It is simply, as a friend of mine once put it, a train wreck. We have this terrible system. Nobody knows, in all likelihood, what the law is in a great many places because there is an inconsistency between federal and state law. Congress can address this problem. It's the only body that can. Congress doesn't want to address it because it knows that some people on one side or the other are going to get angry. Too bad. Okay, your job is to solve national problems. So figure out which proposal is best to solve this problem and then get it done. Okay, third.
Wait, can I go back for number two? Would I, if I was had that job and I'm going to Congress and I say, if I say too bad, get it done, I don't know if I'd get very far, but what I'd say, let's have a set of regulations. Protections that we could agree on?
Now, don't punt to an agency. Uh-huh. The president can make Congress do its job. Congressmen want various things from the president, including getting their staffers appointed to positions in a new administration. You tell the members of Congress you're not going to get any of these goodies unless and until you come together to address this problem.
But when you say address this problem, do you mean legalize, not legalize, or regulate? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Either outlaw it nationwide and then enforce the law.
Okay. Well, I don't know how that's going to happen after all the states wanted this done.
Oh, well, it is impossible for the federal government to coerce the states to help them. But if the Justice Department aggressively goes after people that sell cannabis and goes after them under the forfeiture laws and takes away their business, that will get their attention.
Yeah, but I don't see that happening because the states love the potential, I say potential of tax revenue. They don't realize that it's actually costing them on the other end.
Yeah, well, make that point in the process. In a great many states, they're probably more in the red than in the black. You need that to come out.
Okay. All right. That's number two.
The third and last point I would make is dealing with fentanyl. Talk to the president of Mexico and say, unless you get back on board helping us stop the flow of fentanyl into the United States and in the hands of the cartels, I'm just going to shut down the border. Mexico is not going to be happy if we do that. They don't want that, and we don't want that. So they know financially it would be very harmful, and so we need to get them on board. We also need to figure out what, if any, additional legislation is necessary to deal with the money laundering problem, the problem that money coming out of, you know, China is investing is dirty because they've gotten the cash from the drug trafficking organizations. And then work with the intelligence agencies to soup up their ability to trace these things.
What about dealing with China?
Well, you know, China wants things from the U.S. and they don't want some others. So it's a negotiation. Figure out what it is, you know, we are willing to give up and make a trade.
All right. Diplomacy. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things that policy affects that ends up downstream that people are suffering. I think maybe ending with, what's the smartest drug policy that you've ever come across?
I think the smartest drug policy is one that doesn't expect perfection. And unfortunately, we have too many people demanding perfection. You're going to have some problems no matter what drug policy you adopt. We tried prohibition and it had some positives. There was a reduced incidence of cirrhosis of the liver, reduced incidence of alcoholism resulting in death. But we decided those benefits weren't worth the costs. We made that sort of balance. We need to be honest about that here. Now, I know asking politicians to be honest is like asking water to run upstream. I realize that. But if the president comes out and is honest with the nation, you know, looking past the Congress, the way the president can use his or her bully pulpit, maybe we can start the discussion towards dealing with problems that reduce to the extent possible, not eliminate, but reduce to the maximum extent possible, the problems we have with any substance abuse, including tobacco and alcohol.
Interesting. Great. Paul Larkin, thank you so much. What an honor to be able to speak with you and get this opinions, understand policies, what it could do, what it can't do. And really appreciate it.
Hey, the honor is all mine. I hope that I was able to offer you something useful. I hope your listeners will take away something useful from what you tell them. And feel free, if you ever want to discuss this topic or others again, I'm glad to help.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more high truths.